This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news as we present an in-depth discussion of the developments behind the headlines. Joining us this afternoon, Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Chris Graves, WCPO.com issues reporter Lisa Bernard Kuhn, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. And you can join the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good to see everybody this afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about the case involving Maribel Trujillo Diaz. The 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals this week cleared the way for her to be deported to Mexico, and she had been living in Fairfield with her family. Chris, can you give us some background about her and how she came to be in this country?
Yeah, sure. And she crossed into the United States in February 2002 into Phoenix. I will tell you, I'm not exactly sure why that was or if she was fleeing something or coming here for a better life. But she sort of got involved in the immigration system when she was arrested as part of the Cook Food raid, where authorities arrested roughly 180 immigrants. And that's where she first got detected and sort of got on the radar of immigration. And so from 2002 until current day, her case has sort of winded its way through immigration court, which is a long and laborious route. So that's how she came sort of to be here and in the system where she's now, as you all know, and your listeners all know, that she was, she's scheduled to be deported, I believe,
on the 19th,
week,
I believe, right. The Wednesday, yeah.
Back to Mexico from Louisiana. She's currently being held in Louisiana.
Okay. And why did the court, Tana, not grant her request for an emergency stay? Did they give a reason for that?
The court's decision basically said that she, you know, her appeal was moot because she had 30 days to apply from the date that she was originally scheduled for final deportation, and that was 2 years prior to this. So they said she had no standing to file, so they dismissed it, which is what the attorney general had asked for.
Chris, do we know, had you been making attempts to become a U.S. citizen?
No, she had not.
Okay.
So she's here undocumented, and that means she came over with no visa, no paperwork. And she had sort of been in the system and had sort of, once she got arrested, there's all kinds of levers that start to be pulled in the system. And she first appeared with her lawyer on the immigration's master calendar, it's called, and admitted truth to the allegations as they were brought related to the Cook Food raid. After that, in February 2011, she applied for asylum. There are essentially, I'm boiling all of this very complex immigration law down to its very essence. And then by July 2012, she had an asylum hearing, and the ruling for the immigration judge was that she didn't file her asylum petition in a timely manner. She did not prove that she was being persecuted. And that she would be likely to be persecuted in the future. She also did not prove that there was clear probability that her life or freedom would be threatened if she was sent back. And the judge did find that she was credible, that she was telling the truth, that there was no findings that she had anything criminal in her background. But essentially, in some pretty, not really biting, but some stern language, in the testimony, essentially said she and her lawyer at that time, different lawyers than she has today, didn't really sort of do the necessary things they needed to do to prove that she was a candidate for asylum.
Wasn't she asking for asylum? That wasn't one of the claims she made, that she was fleeing the cartels in Mexico?
The claim that she made is that her brother had been targeted by one of the cartels, and in fact that they had pushed him and forced him to work for them. By the time that claim is made, she had to, my understanding of the records is she had to prove that she was a target. And so there was a lot of back and forth in that testimony from years ago that she didn't prove that she was. Just because you, my understanding is just because you think you may be a target doesn't necessarily make you a target. And there was no supporting documentation from her brother, who also fled, also left Mexico. And based on those documents, had applied for asylum as well. And I don't know the status of his case. And then subsequent to that, more recently, her father had allegedly had been kidnapped by one of the cartels. And her mother was, the allegation is her, the cartel extorted 20,000 pesos to get him back. And so that's the subsequent, that's what brings us here today, the emergency request April 3rd by her now lawyers, where she's applying for emergency asylum again, saying if you, there's this deportation order that's been in place for the last, I think, 3 years. And so now her new lawyers say, wait a minute, we now have new information that came to light February 2017 that her father had been kidnapped by the cartel. And then so current day, her argument is, if you send me back, I will be targeted because of cartels target family. And it's a pretty well-documented fact that women are particularly targeted by the Mexican cartels.
So where is she now, Tana?
Well, like Chris said, she's still in the detention facility in LaSalle Parish, Louisiana.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is there the possibility that she gets moved from there before she's finally deported?
It is possible she could be moved. You know, her attorney has said that ICE likes to move people around a lot. And, of course, we saw that there was, as the Sixth Circuit court hearing was coming up, there was kind of a real push to get her, it seemed, quickly out of Ohio as well.
Now, what about her family? She had a husband and I think, what, three or four children?
Just four children.
Four children. Mm-hmm. What about them? What becomes of them?
They're here. They live in Fairfield. Her husband is also undocumented and is taking care of the children. So I saw them last night. They obviously are distraught. She has her children range in the age of 14 to 3. And the last I knew, they had made an application. The Mexican consulate had asked ICE to see if she could take her three-year-old back. Her three-year-old suffers from a medical condition that force her into seizures that her mother has cared for.
So I guess they went after her because they had her on the radar.
Yeah,
where her
exactly.
husband they haven't had any contact with. So
that's my understanding. Okay. Yes. Okay. So her lawyers say essentially, you know, she's, and this is not the best phrase, but she had an electronic monitoring bracelet on, so ICE was tracking her the whole time. So a week ago, Monday, so the 3rd, she went in for her regularly scheduled monthly meeting with immigration officials. She was told at that time to have a deportation, have her plan for deportation ready, which included having plane tickets. Mike Pucky. I'm probably mispronouncing his name.
I believe that's correct, with St. Julie Billy Art in Hamilton.
Right, yeah, said then ICE never asked for them, so they thought, oh, you know, told her to come back May 1st. Literally 48 hours later, she's walking to work to her family, and I just discovered today, in fact, just found that three immigration, sort of two vans and a car kind of came up and grabbed her, and I mean— they would have known her routine because she was being, you know, she was being monitored.
Yeah, she had the monitor on. So
right.
And is it correct? I mean, to my knowledge, we still don't know why they chose to pick her up that day. Correct, after a seemingly normal visit.
Yes, I haven't completely confirmed. Again, her lawyers say. I mean, she has a deportation order in place. I think I don't know this as a fact, but I do think that perhaps there may have been some miscommunication in that Monday meeting. Mm. But I don't know that for a fact. Certainly have that question in.
So it's been my sense that when moments like this come up in communities, especially communities with large immigrant populations, it really sends ripples through that community. You guys have been covering this. I mean, what kind of sense do you get that the neighbors and the community that supported this family is fearful or has concerns about just their own well-being and security here.
Oh, go ahead.
Either one.
I think that's absolutely true. I think there are, to quote the pastor, the priest at St. Julie's, you know, and I'll quote him. He says, you know, I don't ask how many of my parishioners have papers. The only paper I ask for is baptismal. Mm-hmm. Last night at church, it did not come up. I mean, it was Holy Thursday, obviously. Did not come up, but you could see groups of primarily Spanish-speaking folks, and I do not speak Spanish, but concerned, sort of rallying around or talking with the family, wishing them well. There were several people who went up, and I was told were praying for her. I mean, separate yeah. from separate from that, I have heard her larger family. So there are other family here, some legally and some undocumented, that there is a bit of concern.
Yeah. And that community has been concerned for a long time. I mean, the sheriff has made, Sheriff right. Richard Jones has made it, you know, abundantly clear that he wants immigrants that are here illegally out and, you know, has gone to measures, had some of his deputies ICE training and whatnot. So, certainly. You know, people have been living in sort of fear for a while up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is it fair to say, Tana, they see this particular case and the way it's gone as a precursor for what could happen to other undocumented immigrants?
I should certainly yeah. think so, yes.
Yeah. I think that our immigration reporter, Mark Knute, is actually working on a story for this weekend. I'm plugging him a little bit, but that talks about that a little bit. Again, I think there's a big concern that Maribel and I don't know if people remember, but there was a gentleman in Indiana, again, no criminal record, business owner, mayor rallied around him. Everybody sort of came very similar, letter writing, and he was deported. So a lot of people think, oh, well, here's a case. There's a couple other cases, very similar. There's the real concern that, you know, you get this electronic bracelet on, you're escalating. You know, she used to have meetings once a year, then they went to twice a year. Now they were monthly. She had an electronic monitoring bracelet on a couple of years ago. It got taken off. Again, different political administration. And just recently, I believe it was either February or March, got the bracelet back on again. And so I think there's a concern that the government's watching us. They know our every movement. I think we'll begin to see people who were beginning to talk about living in this country sort of beginning. I've sent some of that. People won't give me their names again. They won't talk about things. They're very, very concerned that if their name or their anything gets out, they could be a target.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And let's talk with Mario in Lebanon. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. My question is with regards to the actual arrest of Ms. Trujillo. Was she utilizing someone else's identity or someone else's security, social security number? Because that in itself creates a big problem here in the United States when you have people from other countries who are not invited here attempting to work and use the identity of United States citizens.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for your call. That is not true. I just talked with some folks who were there when she was arrested and detained by ICE, and they provided her deportation order as the grounds to make the arrest. I've been repeatedly told by all of her lawyers, the priest, her family, that she has never violated any law, and that certainly, using someone else's identity would certainly be a violation of law.
Now, Ohio Senators Rob Portman, Sherrod Brown, they've come out in support.
They have.
Haven't they? Yeah.
Yeah, they have. They've tried to intervene on her behalf and call immigration officials. The truth is, I don't know how much standing they can try.
Right. Yeah, that was kind of my question as well, because especially interesting there is you have a Republican and a Democrat mm-hmm. who are, you know, advocating on her behalf and unsuccessfully. So it is interesting to wonder how much sway they would have.
Right.
Does she have any other legal options or any options, period, at this point?
She does. They are not much. There have been some cases in the past, and I will say this again, I'm not the expert here, but there has been a case or two in the past where a lawmaker will intervene and essentially introduce some legislation specifically targeted at one person to sort of give them entry in. I'm boiling all of this very complicated stuff down.
The immigration law and the immigration issue is just complicated.
It's very complicated.
That's one thing I sense from what you're saying, Chris. This is just a very complicated case, period.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's long. It's long right. And lots of, as I said, it's gone on, you know, for roughly the last 10 years since she was arrested and sort of began to show the quagmire of the crossroads of being here illegally and what you can and can't do. And I would suggest, you know, a difference in political administrations, you know. 2 years ago, the same priest had a letter-writing campaign when it looked like her deportation was imminent. Again, she sort of got, for lack of a better term, pushed, it seems, sort of down to the bottom of the list, given mm-hmm. a couple more years to get some things in order. A couple more years come, different political administration, different outcome. I'm just, you know, not making a political statement, just saying that you've got some, you know—
Yeah,
same things kind of happen.
Change in administration and change in the policies toward
right.
immigration.
Definitely. And in theory, her attorneys could try to appeal the Sixth Circuit court ruling, but they've told us that they don't intend to do that.
Because
at this
wasn't the full panel, was it, Tan? It was just I think it was
three judge panel.
But, so yeah. They could appeal to the whole Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, but don't know yet.
I don't think they're going to do that.
Right.
That's
and
my
their
understanding.
Current intention is not to.
Yeah.
But you asked for all the options.
Yeah, she's a bit at the end of her rope, I'm afraid, which is, you know, I mean, again, the other thing is that, and I can't state this too strongly, her children are American born. She has four American born children who are here. Another option, if she gets deported, or when she gets deported, her oldest son will be 21 in 7 years. He could then appeal and have her, you know, brought back. That's 7 years. So I think the fear is that if she goes down there and again, and if her family is targeted by the cartels, and that she may be in harm's way. And, you know, I think that's their real fear. And the other issue not to be lost in this entire conversation is what you said at the very beginning, and that is this doesn't appear to be the kind of—
Yeah, the profile of the typical person they would go
right,
after.
Right.
Yeah.
She has no criminal record. She's not involved in gangs. She's never been involved in violence. She doesn't, I mean, none of those things. So
One question I might ask, and you probably can't answer it, but it is one that you see a lot in comments on stories about this. Well, she's had all this time to apply, and she never had until now. So I think a lot of people who are saying that in the media she's being portrayed too sympathetically, or what they say, she had all this time. Why didn't she, you know, apply? Why now? Why should we care now?
I will tell you, I have that question into a couple of experts. I don't know. I don't know the answer, to be completely honest. But I've read those comments as well.
You know, I get the sense that the pathway to citizenship, I mean, it's not even clear for us, right, who sit
right.
here and
mm-hmm.
have the benefit of always being an American citizen. And so coming into a country and trying to navigate that and figure that out and know the deadlines and the inner workings of that legal framework, it's just overwhelming to me. And so I don't know how you expedite anything like that. I mean, our country's pathway to citizenship has looked differently, you know, sometimes year after year, decade after decade. So I just, it's hard to have a clear answer, I think, on just how quickly somebody can actually
right.
move through that.
And I imagine not inexpensive.
Indeed.
And she doesn't speak the language. She's still
right.
only, I mean, to this day is very limited in her English and finding people to help you. I think, you know, it's just a tough,
yeah.
it's a tough road.
We will continue our review of news affecting the tri-state area, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news as we present a discussion of the developments behind the headlines. And joining us this afternoon, Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Chris Graves, WCPO.com issues reporter Lisa Bernard Kuhn, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. Let's talk about where medical marijuana stands. You've been covering this quite a bit, Lisa. It was legalized in Ohio last year.
Yes.
September, it became legal.
Correct.
And the state's still working on putting the structure in place for dealing with this new law. So
that's
pick
right.
up from there. I mean, where do things
yeah,
stand?
Yeah, yeah. So when it was legalized, built into that law was a two-year rulemaking period where three departments at the state level are crafting the rules for how to grow medical marijuana, how to manufacture it and produce it into products that people are going to be able to consume. What are the rules around dispensing it and selling it? Lots of rules for a patient registration and creating guidelines around the kinds of certifications that physicians are going to need to recommend the drug. And so, as you can imagine, literally thousands of laws are being written as we speak that will really build the framework for this market and industry such that it will be by September 2018 when all of this work is to be buttoned up and folks can go buy their medical marijuana.
And that's the thing that's always fascinated me about this. They passed the law making it legal, but then they still have to pass all these myriad other laws and rules to make this work. I mean, it's just seems kind of backward.
It does. It's happened this way in other states. And so what's just really interesting about the way that this medical marijuana market is being shaped state by state, it looks very differently. And we've got a balance now of more than half the states in the country have some kind of marijuana, legal marijuana-related law on the book, right, on the books. And so eventually, as you get sort of toward the end of that, you're hoping that some of the best practices or perhaps what bubbles up in your state, and certainly it's still to be seen in Ohio, how all of this is going to come together. But a lot has been proposed, a lot's being reviewed right now. So,
yeah, and the other thing I wonder too is there any possibility that this just falls off the rails, that this never happens? With all that remains to be done,
I would say anything is possible. However, the likelihood that this would totally fall off the rails in Ohio at this point, it doesn't seem likely. You have a pretty solid framework for how the market would look, again, with these sort of three key pieces of the industry, cultivation, manufacturing, and testing. I forgot to mention testing. And you see already there's a lot of solid proposals out there for how this market would be regulated. And if you think about how alcohol is regulated sort of on a state-by-state basis, this is going to look pretty similar. If you walk into a dispensary in Ohio, the goal is that it's not unlike walking into sort of an Ohio licensed liquor agency, right? So these are going to be basically operations that have a state license to operate, and you're going to get to go in and you're going to choose your medicine of choice, so to speak. So
2018 is what they're shooting for.
September 2018 is when by law the full medical marijuana program is to be up and running. What we know in terms of what that might look like, there's at least 24 cultivation licenses that will be available. So that means 24 places across Ohio will be growing medical marijuana, medical grade marijuana. Of those, 12 of those will be large processor or large cultivators, 25,000 square feet or more. 12 of them will be small. So around 3,000 square feet, and the pricing structure and sort of the guidelines for how they're to operate look a little differently. Outside of the growing of the marijuana, then the dispensing of it, there will be at least 40 dispensary licenses available. So across the state, 40 places where you can go in and buy your medical marijuana. And so that begins to give you a sense of where you might be able to purchase medical marijuana. You're probably going to see a lot of the metro areas, licensed folks that have business plans sort of near a metro area will be applying for this. And there's a lot of guidelines about, you know, how far you have to be if you want to be a dispensary operator, how far you need to be from schools and other sort of operations. So it's all coming together right now, and it's pretty fascinating, I think, when you think that this is really an industry that's being built from the ground up.
And just 40 dispensaries across the state, so there's the possibility some people might have to travel a ways to get their prescription filled.
There is, yeah. I may get this estimate wrong, but I think the estimates are, you know, Ohio will have, when you look at the number of conditions that will be allow a patient to take medical marijuana, I think it's about 26-ish conditions, chronic pain, cancer, epilepsy, a couple others. When you begin to look at that patient population in Ohio, I think there's about 300,000 patients that could fall into that category. And that's large. So you think about Colorado, for example, the number of medical marijuana cardholders in Colorado, which was one of the first states to really begin to broach this, they have about 100,000-ish patients that have a medical marijuana card. So we're looking at three times the size of that market, right? But 300,000 patients getting to shop at 40 dispensaries.
Does that mean Ohio is the biggest, is going to be one of the
it
biggest?
It could be among the biggest. And so that's from just sort of the economics of this industry. The stories behind those who are wanting to get into this market are really interesting because they're vying to be part of what could be one of the largest medical marijuana markets in the country. So the potential for some serious revenue exists in their mind.
How does Ohio have that many more people? Are the eligibility things?
Population,
just
right? Like we're
population.
Just, we're, I think we're like the seventh-ish largest state. As beautiful and awesome as Colorado might be, you know, our folks
just
haven't moved there
many,
yet.
Yeah,
that's
just,
right.
Just don't have as many people there.
Okay. We're still going to Florida. But yeah.
So who are some of these investors who are hoping to get in on the medical marijuana business? You've been writing about this and covering this. So who are some of these folks?
Yeah, so one local one is James Gould. He's a local Cincinnati investor, entrepreneur, really made his way as a sports agent. He worked with Donald Trump for many years early on in his career.
Wasn't he one of the backers of the referendum to legalize pot across the board a few years back?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Made his money with Build-A-Bear, if we think of Build-A-Bear. He made his money with Build-A-Bear. Then fast forward many, many years later to like 2015-ish, he was one of the backers of Issue 3 that wanted to legalize recreational and medical marijuana here in Ohio. That failed. A lot of people, if you recall, they referred to that as the monopoly.
Right, but he wanted to become Build-A-Bud.
Build-A-Bud, yeah, basically. Yeah, right. Laugh at that, I think.
No, that was
great.
Good.
But their campaign, Issue 3's campaign mascot was Buddy. Do you remember that?
Right.
It was like the big marijuana bud dressed up that went around to college campuses. But at any rate,
very odd looking. But
very
yes.
odd looking. They dumped a lot of money into that campaign, you know, upwards of $20 million, and really began to raise awareness around just legalization of marijuana in general. And so here we are now. It's legal medically. He has all along said he wants to get in. He wants to become – he and his partners, right? So he has amassed several business partners. They're looking to spend roughly $40 million to build a medical marijuana campus in Wilmington, Ohio. And he's just one of, I would say, dozens of folks across Ohio who are trying to figure out, you know, where do they get the foot in their door on this market?
Yeah. Who else is among the folks who are looking to invest?
Yeah, so I talked to – so you have the Goulds out there, the James Goulds of Ohio, who have sort of what seem to be very firm business plans in place. And then you have others who they're really willing to risk their life savings to get into this. And they perhaps don't have the capital, but they really have a passion around it. I talked to a gentleman named Brett Adams, who owns a chain of restaurants up in Northeast Ohio. And I can't remember the name of the restaurants, but they are sort of wildly popular neighborhood restaurants. And he wants to take that kind of community support he's built around this restaurant chain and turn it into a take that passion and put it into medical marijuana. He wants to, I think, launch a small grow facility and perhaps do some dispensaries around it. He's very passionate around the pain relief and the medicinal value of medical marijuana. And he's out there looking for a community to support his plans, right? So this is not sort of your traditional business venture where you come up with a business plan and you get to you get it underwritten and you take it to the bank, so to speak. You have to have a community that's willing to support you and what it is that you're wanting to do. And so a lot of local lobbying that has to happen to get buy-in to then go on and spend millions of dollars.
Aren't there a number of communities in Ohio, too, who are putting laws in place to keep the dispensaries out?
Yes, dispensaries, so starting on just the growing of the medical marijuana, as part of the application process, large growers, any grower, rather, has to, within their application, make sure that they're in a community that hasn't banned any marijuana-related businesses from operating. So they have to show proof of that. We know Fairfield, for example, I think is the most recent that decided to ban marijuana-related businesses, and a number of municipalities across Ohio have been taking that move or putting a moratorium in place to say, you know, we just want to wait and see how this whole industry comes together before we decide if it's right for our community. Same thing with dispensaries. So you really need a lot of community support depending on where it is that you want your venture to be up and running.
Yeah, community support. And it sounds like in some cases you might need a lot of cash to do this too.
A ton of cash.
How much do we know?
So just from the licensing standpoint, cultivators, for example, if you want to be a large cultivator, it's a $20,000 application fee. And then annually, it's $180,000 to renew that license. On the smaller side of that, if you want to be one of these smaller growers, it's a $2,000 application fee. Annually, it's $18,000 to renew. There will be many folks who apply and lose that application fee. It's non-refundable. So, you know, out of the gate, if you're looking to get in on this at the large level as a large cultivator, you're risking a $20,000 loss. So...
So they're looking at they're saying, yeah, there's a risk, but there's the potential for a big market, a lot of reward here.
There is. Like. I mean, considering Ohio could be one of the largest markets, but I don't know that anyone knows. I asked James Gould, for example, okay, so you want to, you know, operate this 25,000 square foot facility in Wilmington, Ohio, and you're willing to invest $40 million. What piece of the market can you capture with that? Are you running the numbers to know sort of if you're operating at that size, what market you know, what slice of the market are you going to be able to potentially obtain? And I did not get a straight answer. You know, it's wait and see.
Where are you headed next in your coverage of this story, Lisa?
I think all of these stories about the folks that want to get in on this. I mean, they're fascinating stories and they're very personal stories that it's the full spectrum of folks who are looking to create a business. Like I mentioned with the gentleman, Brett Adams up in Northeast Ohio, he wants to be a part of this industry because he can pass it on to his children. He really sees it as something that will be sustainable enough to become a family legacy. And then you have the Goulds of the world who they're interested in it for some of those reasons, but also it's something new to be a part of. And so those stories really intrigue me. They're really fascinating.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news, and joining us this afternoon, Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Chris Graves, WCPO.com issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner. You can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, it's been almost a year since the mass shooting that occurred in Pike County. I think the exact date was April 22nd.
That's correct.
Of last year. Right. Let's start with some background. We got an update yesterday from the Ohio Attorney General and the Pike County Sheriff. But Chris, take us back a little bit and remind us, refresh us on this story. What happened?
Absolutely. Most complex investigation in Ohio history started with the deaths of eight family members. Complex because the crime scenes were in three trailers and a camper on family land in rural Pike County. Most likely in the early morning hours, most likely at least two killers involved. Highly methodical, calculated, did not leave much in the way of sort of forensic crime scene evidence, which I think has really complicated this case a bit, sort of captured the attention nationally for a while and sort of fell off here for a bit. So it was the conversation with Attorney General DeWine and Pike County Sheriff Charles Reeder yesterday was really, just to be completely clear, was really not about new information. It was more to take reporter questions related to the anniversary, which is coming up.
And was part of it to say, too, that we're still working on this? We still haven't given up
so.
On this?
Yeah, okay. And they have been. I mean, if you look at the numbers, just the number of tips that have come in has more than doubled since August, which is the last time I reported that. So there are still tips coming in. They still are processing evidence. Just looking at the sheer number, they've executed more search warrants since I would roughly around I think the last time I reported it, it was about 28, and yesterday they said 41. So they're obviously doing work. We have reported prior. This didn't come up yesterday, but we have reported prior one of the family members, the sister of—
And this was the Roden family, right?
The Roden family. Yeah. That's right. That's right. And then also two other families are involved by marriage or almost marriage, and that would be the Gilly family and the Manley family. And those are by marriage into the Roden family.
But I sidetracked you. You were headed toward—
I was. That they were one of the certainly one of the sisters of Dana Roden, one of the victims, has twice been, she says, twice been hauled in to have a lie detector test. She says she's passed both of those. Now, I will tell you, neither Charlie Reeder or the Attorney General will confirm or deny any of those things. They have been very, very, very tight-lipped about the investigation, what they know, what they don't know, if they have even suspects, what a motive is. It's a real, I will tell you, in almost, 20-some years of police reporting, I've never seen an investigation locked down like this. I mean, they are tight. So much of the information that has come out about the crime itself has come from family members.
Do they feel like they're getting enough information and enough help on this case?
Oh, the police?
Yeah.
Oh, no, not at all. They are frustrated. Part of the press briefing yesterday, Charlie Reeder, who is a lifelong Pike Countyan, grew up there, came up in law enforcement there. I mean, literally was choked up through much of it, had tears in his eyes. And I believe him. I mean, I think he feels this very personally and implored business owners and anybody to come forward and build up the reward. The reward is at $10,000, which if you do the math per victim, which is not it's kind of crass, but not very much money. And so really asking anybody can, donate $100 or $1,000 or $25,000. And he has repeatedly said, made threats that if people are not coming forward, he will arrest them. They fundamentally and categorically believe there are people in that community that know information and will not come forward. The Attorney General again yesterday said, hey, this is a murder investigation, a multiple murder investigation. if you're worried about anything that you've done that's a crime, don't worry about that. Our bigger win in here is to catch the killers, you know. Now, he wouldn't really say what he meant by that, what kind of criminal enterprises. But and that has, I mean, to be completely honest, almost since day one, they've said that, that this was going to take a long time. It was going to be complicated. I think, you know, again, to quote the attorney general, he said this since the summer, you know, they're finding out a lot about Pike County and sort of the underbelly they're in. And again, won't, that's really intriguing, but we don't know what that means.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Just how small is Pike County? I know it's small. We continue to talk about it as a small rural county. Or do we have a – I'm just wondering, in the thousands of people.
And kind of set us up geographically. Where is Pike
County,
too?
Sorry. Yeah.
That's okay.
I'm happy to Google some of those, too.
Yeah, yeah. If you could I reported that way back,
yeah,
like a year ago.
Or
so my brain,
maybe. Yeah, we'll
yeah geographically,
there.
It is sort of on off of Highway 32. If you go sort of out of Cincinnati, about 90 minutes down 32. And to be completely fair, this is on right on the border of Scioto County and Pike County and Adams County, believe it or not.
And if am I correct in saying, if you draw a line straight down from Columbus, doesn't that run into Pike County? Isn't it pretty much straight down?
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not quite evenly between Columbus and Cincinnati, but it's sort of there, very, you know, very rural. It's beautiful. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. Rolling hills, the foothills of Appalachia, excuse me, where, you know, where people take care of each other, they take care of themselves. I think that one of the reasons this case has really reverberated there is the ripples of just families, that one family would be targeted, and I think sort of the trauma that's left after, both to the region and to the larger Roden family, and to a lesser extent, but certainly the Manleys and the Gillies, is, you know, how could this have happened?
Yeah,
we take care of our own here.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about the mood of the community. What they're feeling about this?
Yeah, so I will tell you, it has changed over the last year. I mean, when I first went down a year ago, it was on the tips of the tongue of everybody. There was fear that dissipated fairly rapidly once it looked like it was highly targeted. There wasn't sort of a bunch of killers roaming sort of the Appalachian Hills, but there was fear. I will say I was down there a couple of weeks ago and asked just that question of people at the courthouse and local cafes. And I said, you know, we think about it, but we don't really talk about it anymore. And I will tell you, the family's very concerned about that point. You know, I have a story coming out next week that talks about sort of the family and where they're at, and talks to experts about sort of this lingering trauma and those sorts of things when you live for a year with no answers.
I guess at this point, the message from law enforcement, though, is that we're not done. We haven't given
up
on this
case. They have a small team of state agents, as well as one deputy, Pike County deputy. It's a small department, so there's only one deputy assigned there in an undisclosed location. So they still have sort of a command center, you know, with their stuff. They're up. I've actually physically seen them on the property in the last, when I've been there, hit and miss. So yeah, I mean, I believe they are doing things. I think they're doing a fair amount of pretty sophisticated forensic work. I've been led to believe that. Lots of extraction.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
At the time, there was all this talk about it was drug-related, and then there was something about the family being involved in Demolition Derby and everything. And I'm just wondering if you can refresh us whatever came of those concerns.
Certainly, yeah. So two of the victims, Christopher Roden Sr. and his brother, Kenneth Roden, they did find what the attorney general has classified as commercial marijuana grow operations. He will not expand on that or say definitively whether we're talking hundreds of plants or thousands of plants or millions of dollars. There was speculation very early on, primarily in the media and not by law enforcement, that, well, this is, you know, it's got to be a Mexican drug cartel. in recent, probably the last 2 or 3 months, I've sensed Sheriff Reeder backing off of that a little bit and not making such a big deal. I think that that sort of overcame the story, and I think that Sheriff Reeder thinks that there's a feeling in the community that, well, if they were doing all this drug stuff, they deserved everything they got. And the demolition derby, they are the families heavily involved in demolition derbies. That has sort of been ruled out as a cause. There was some back and forth about that, but I don't think anybody believes that's a motive. But again, anything's possible. I mean, it's a bizarre crime.
Tana, let's talk about the numbers that came out this week. Cradle Cincinnati, most recent report on infant mortality in our area. And there was some good news in this particular report.
Right. Well, they came out. They do this report every year since the agency's inception a few years back. And they do say that the infant mortality rate is doing better. It kind of tends to sort of shift all around the same actual number of babies who are dying before their first birthdays. But it's doing good. They keep saying that it's down. We're no longer in the bottom 10 cities nationwide in terms of infant mortality. But we are still in the bottom 30. So that's, you know, good and bad still.
They also had some concerns, though, about birth defects, I believe.
Right. So in the past, you know, they've got their kind of three key areas that they've focused on: sleep-related deaths and preterm births. But this year they said birth defects is where we're seeing the most growth, which is not a good type of growth. And specifically, fatal heart defects are a concern. So that's one area that they're going to start looking a little bit more about that. Ryan Adcock, who's the director of that, said the heart-related birth defect increase could be related to uncontrolled diabetes in pregnant women. So that's one area that maybe some of the doctors will start focusing a little bit more on.
Do they still see a racial disparity in infant mortality?
Yes. Now, they say African-American infant deaths fell 24% over the last 5 years, so that is good. In fact, the county recorded its fewest number of African-American baby infant before their first birthday deaths on record. So that is good. However, the disparity is still high.
So I guess their message is things are getting better, but there's still a lot of work we have to do.
Right. And, you know, the question I ask every year is, you know, we're Cincinnati, we're not New York, we're not LA, we're not a huge city. So how can our rate possibly be so bad? How can we be the worst? And they keep coming back to child poverty, and our childhood poverty rate is just so high.
Yep.
So.
And before we close out, Tana.
Yes.
You got to ride the new roller coaster at Kings Island, from what I hear.
I did. I drew the short straw yesterday, Mark. I had to take one for the team. I can tell you, it was fun. It's a smooth ride if you're worried about wooden roller coasters. And I will not tell you what is in the shed.
Yeah. I saw a video. Now, I have to ask you, when you went on the ride, you're the type, you probably threw your hands up, didn't you?
Well, everybody around me was doing it. So, but I will, yes, I did throw my hands up, but I put them right back on and held on.
The video I saw, there was a gentleman sitting next to you. How did he like the ride?
Oh, he loved it. He had his hands up the entire time. That was an interesting story. He and his friends came from Canada to ride on this first weekend. So, people came from around the country and around the world, apparently, to ride this roller coaster.
And you can see a video of Tana's wild ride at WVXU.org. And thank you for joining me this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Chris Graves, WCPO Insider Issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, and WVXU reporter and digital news editor Tana Weingartner.